before returning to Australia in 1919, there was a Captain Elliot, his nickname was Tab, and he wanted to attend to an important personal matter. So he journeyed beyond the wrecked village of Poppering in Belgium and found himself at the vast cemetery that we now call Lichtenhoek Military Cemetery. With its endless vista of white crosses, he walked along the rows until he found his brother, Theo. Tab stood behind the cross while a caretaker snapped a photograph. He hoped that this photograph would provide his mother Mary Jane some solace after she'd suffered the loss of her son Theo in 1917. Yet Tab also knew there would be no comfort for the unresolved grief that Mary Jane harboured for her other son, Ray, who had disappeared without trace at Fromelles in 1916. Tab had departed Australia with his little brothers in 1915, and in May 1919 he returned home without them. As he walked up the family's homestead's winding drive and past the spreading oaks, he saw the Empire flag that fluttered from the flagpole. It was the same flag that Ray had asked to remain up until they all returned home. Tab married Ellie in 1920. They built a grand house overlooking the Murray River. Tab had seen the dark shadow of war and he wanted to leave it behind. And perhaps that's why, when acquaintances asked him about his experiences as a pilot over the skies of Europe, he always declined to answer. The family's search for answers about Ray's burial location would continue long after the war ended. And for the devastated Mary Jane, the mystery was never resolved. She passed away in 1926, never knowing where her son was buried. Mary won't know this, but Ray does now have a grave because he was one of those that was found at Pheasant Wood and is now buried in a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery not far from where he died. His mother, Mary Jane's experience, was an all too familiar experience for thousands of other Australian families. Of the 62,000 Anzac soldiers who died in the Great War, over one third are still listed as missing. And as I read this story, I'm looking at a grave of Tab, stood behind the wooden cross of his brother Theo, 25th Australian Machine Gun Company. He's placed a wreath there, and now, of course, there'll be a Portland headstone. So welcome once again to the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And this week we turn our attentions to those missing, those nameless names from Australia. And we talk to the author, Scott Bennett, who's written a book by the same name. And it's from that book that I quoted the story of Theo and Ray. And most of the podcast this week will contain an interview with Scott, where we look at the reasons why he wrote this book and some of the stories contained in there of those young Australians that came over to Europe and never went home again, and worst of all, have no known grave. It's an awful story, isn't it? These young men that not only died in battle, whose bodies were never found for whatever reason. And it's a story that we keep going back to because it's so intriguing, isn't it? How did the families ever get over, if they could get over, not just the loss of their sons, brothers, husbands, so far away on the other side of the world, but how did they deal with the added grief of not knowing where they were and, in most cases, what had happened to them? So let's have a listen, shall we, to what Scott has to say. And as we go along, we'll look at one or two more of these stories. I spoke to Scott by Zoom from his home in Melbourne, Australia. And through my fault, it's not Scott's fault, it's my fault that the recording isn't as good as it could be. And that's entirely down to me. But stick with it because the story is, as I say, very inspiring. Oh, well, thanks very much for coming on anyway. I've been reading all your stuff online for quite a while then, Scott. So welcome to the podcast Tales from the Battlefield. So would you mind just introducing yourself and explain, you know, how you got hooked on researching and writing about the Great War?
Yeah, well, look, I like many Australian families, you know, when I was young, you know, a young teenager, you know, when you looked at families, you know, there was always the great-grandfather that fought in World War One, you know, great-uncle or uncle in World War Two, and another uncle in Vietnam. So many families, you know, there was that military tradition. So it was something that was very... continues to be very, very strong in Australia. But it wasn't until about 2000 when I met my future wife, who's English, that we went across to England, and I did want to visit the battlefields.
Yeah.
And I must say it had an absolute profound impact upon me.
Yeah.
Victor Pozieres, which is a location where 23,000 Australians were killed or wounded, and to visit that location, and, you know, I had no idea what I'd see. But it's just, you know, a little farmlet, and it's very hard to comprehend for an Australian 10,000 miles away, you know, how 23,000, you know, soldiers could be killed or wounded for what looked like an insignificant location. So that really sparked my interest in it, and wrote my first book, Pozieres, which was about that battle, trying to understand that battle.
Yeah.
And... you know, in this case, as we're talking about the missing, what I never comprehended was that, you know, a third of Australia is dead, similar to the British Empire ratio, was missing, bodies never discovered or never identified, which for me was very hard to comprehend. And I suppose the book for me was Australia digitised all its soldier dossiers. So 420,000 dossiers.
And they're complete, aren't they? Not like the British records where ours have been mainly destroyed. They're all complete.
Oh, all complete, yeah. About 4.5 million records with those dossiers of the 420,000 soldiers. But what really got me is within those dossiers, you basically read the letters from mothers who their son is missing.
Yeah.
And they can't comprehend what that means. They're searching for information. Just the anguish and grief. And these letters, it wasn't just 1916, 17, 18, but, you know, these letters continued to come into base records, you know, into the 20s and 30s. People, you know, mothers and fathers searching for answers.
So. It's until the mothers die, isn't it? It's until they die, they never give up, do they?
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, you can imagine a mother losing a son and, you know, searching for answers. So often the newspapers in Australia would report finds of bodies, that, whether it be Pozieres or Passchendaele, and you'd often, if you follow the newspapers or follow the dossiers, you can actually see mothers saying, hey, there's been a find, my son died near there, do you have any information, can you tell me anything? So, you know, many mothers and fathers would have taken that grief to the grave.
Mm. And do you have any relatives that served in the war?
Well, Terry, I do... In fact, I featured one of my relatives in my first book. He actually ran away from home as a 14-year-old, enlisted, got across to the Western Front. The authorities found out eventually his parents, which were my great-grandparents, you know, communicated with authorities. They eventually got him back. He ran away again and... was wounded, but at Ypres, he must have been probably 15 or 16 then,
really?
1917, and he actually threatened to shoot an officer and was given 10 years penal servitude.
Oh, blimey.
So, that was a bit of a case, and the Minister of Defence had to get involved, and they basically sent him back to Australia, released him, sent him back to Australia. But it was interesting, my first book... that piece wasn't actually known, so it wasn't until those dossiers were digitised that story actually came out. So it was quite interesting for me because you've got the myth, you know, always the myth of the Anzac, and this was sort of, you know, working down and finding that it was probably a more complex story than the simple story we had when I was a child that, you know, he's some sort of hero, which, you know, on his day probably was, but at the same time...
Yep.
You know, he's convicted for, you know, threatening to shoot an officer.
Mm.
I did have another great uncle, and he died a week before the Great War ended. He actually died of pneumonia, which could have been Spanish flu. And he is buried at Abbeville in France. And again, same thing for me. I was the first relative after 100 years to actually visit his grave. Yeah. So again, you know, profound impact, you know, standing in a 19-year-old person's grave, a relative, that, you know, that grave hasn't been visited for 100 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, people talk about, you know, there's a gap of 100 years, you know, there's no connection, but there is a real connection. And obviously you'd see that with what you do, that even separated by two or three generations, you know, people are connected to their past, people are connected to their culture. So that's the thing that really interests me, you know, the battlefield tactics and whatnot, that's interesting. But for me, it's that, you know, human connection.
Definitely.
That we maintain, you know, with what we call the past.
Because we can feel it, can't we? And it impacts, you know, I was recording a podcast yesterday and at the end of it, I thought, well, it does connect with us now. There's shadows and memories, and it will always have an impact on future generations as long as we continue to tell those stories, I think, isn't it?
Well, I think it actually still does, you know, touch generations. You know, I remember researching a soldier, Ralph Elkin Smythe, who was killed at Pozieres, and was able to trace his family through, and he had some young boys. You know, those young boys remember their mother forever wearing navy blue, which was the mourning colour. They remember them struggling, you know, just for accommodation, just to have ends meet. You know, those couple of those boys actually went off to war themselves, and, you know, it cycled right through even to their grandchildren that, you know, went back to Pozieres to visit. So, you know, it had impacted their life, it impacted the quality of the life, so it actually fed through the generations. So I think that sometimes, you know, we sort of see it as sepia tone pictures or, you know, but it's in many ways what we are today is, you know, what happened to us, you know, 100 years ago.
Well, I feel that, and I think you do as well. You know, we're from that same generation, aren't we? And we, you know, we went out there about the same time. You know, the early part of this century, and here we are, like nearly 25 years later, still talking and writing about it. So the Nameless Names, then, how did you, it was September 2020, it was published?
September 2020,
How did that come about then? You chose three brothers then?
Well, I mean, my first book, what I did with my first book, you know, often you can see from the bookshelves, there's lots of military books there, and often it ends with the last bullet being fired. And for me, what I wanted to do was actually trace what happened after the battle, the ramifications right through the 70s and 80s. And that's where I came across the missing. And I think I said earlier, you know, for me, that was very hard to comprehend that of the 60,000 soldiers that died, Australian soldiers that died in Europe, on the Western Front, you know, 20,000 were unidentified. And as I said, you know, digitisation had just occurred of dossiers as well as every single newspaper that's ever been printed in Australia. So there's some rich resources. So, and again, you know, for me, you know, you can tell the story through, you know, official records and whatnot. For me, it was more around the personal story. So really, you know, when, you know, you've been to the Menin Gate, And you can see lists of soldiers. And sometimes it can be a little bit anaesthetising just because it is, you know, it can be a bit...
It's overpowering.
Overpowering. So for me, it was really getting some names off the key memorials, such as the Menin Gate and the Australian National Memorial and the Lone Pine Memorial, and actually telling the story, you know, through sets of brothers. So in essence, it was three sets of brothers... Morden and Lindsay Reed that landed together on Gallipoli on the 25th of April.
Yeah.
And they were actually both killed on the same day, probably about a mile from each other.
Right.
They didn't actually realise that each other was there. But again, you know, you think of it from a mother's perspective, two sons, you know, wasn't killed, they're classified as missing. So
both of them.
You know, the ramifications, you know, were significant there. Second set of brothers, the Flaum brothers, as a German family, three brothers, and again, a tragic story. Brumel, two brothers, 32nd Battalion, and one brother, Theo, came across his brother Ray on the battlefield badly wounded.
Did he?
And, that push-pull of, he's got commands he needs to follow up, but he's got his brother dying in a dugout.
So he's actually, he's not coming out of the battle, he's going into battle and he sees his brother.
He's going into battle, so he's basically moving forward, takes cover in the dugout, and there's his brother who's been, badly wounded, trying to treat him. But he's a lieutenant, he's ahead of a machine gun team, and he has orders. So he actually leaves a soldier with his brother and then basically, pursues his objectives. So, and that was something that, haunted that soldier for a long time. And then there was, three brothers from a place called Jin Jin in far north Queensland. And, two of those brothers, they were in the same battalion, the 49th Battalion. Two, again, missing at Mezzanine's Ridge. The three brothers were in the battalion. Two were basically went into the attack and one was kept in reserve. And the two that went into attack were killed, classified as missing. And then the third brother was went missing at Villers Bretna in April 1918.
So three. We've got two on the same day there at Messines Bridge.
Yeah,
and then another one in 1918, was that then at the end?
Yeah.
These were the Allen brothers. And in Scott's book, this is how he describes what happened. Brothers Josiah and Ned Allen were killed at Messines Ridge on the 7th of June 1917 and the bodies were never found. Beyond a sketchy dossier note containing the cryptic math reference, sheet 28, SW0286MS1, there was little information about their demise. The boys' parents, William and Sarah from Jin Jin in Queensland, struggled to unlock the coordinates' meaning. Little did they know it was wrong, omitting the vital suffix C31. Sarah would eventually die of a broken heart in 1926. 100 years on, while researching the nameless names, Scott says he visited Ypres to get a better understanding of the brothers' story. Armed with the trench map and the correct coordinates, he found where they were reportedly killed. He remembers standing there and absorbing his surroundings. The village of Messines and Wyshater sat in the distance and a few milking cows wandered the nearby fields. The 49th Battalion diary told him that the brothers had reached the rise where he stood. Then late in the afternoon, the British barrage fell short on the brothers' battalion, causing untold casualties. This was likely the moment that they both died, killed by friendly fire. Days later, pioneer soldiers reported burying eight bodies in craters in this exact location. Tragically, the third brother, Ernest, waited expectantly in reserve for his brothers to return. They never did. And it was Ernest, the third brother, that died the following year at Villers Bretonneux. Josiah and Ned are two of the nearly 55,000 names commemorated on the Menin Gate in Ypres.
Yeah. Blimey. So the book, if you look at it, that's probably the only about a third of the story. So for me, probably the biggest story is how they tried to trace what happened to the brother. If you look at the first brother, or first set of brothers, Morden Reed, he was a lieutenant. And went missing at the Third Ridge at Gallipoli. Now, he was married to Pauline Reed, from West Australia. She actually left her job at a hospital and actually sailed across to Cairo because she couldn't find any answers about her missing husband. She actually started work with the Red Cross, eventually went to London, where she worked with the Red Cross, the section that worked dealt with missing or prisoners of war. And, in essence, for 4 years, she was just searching for any answers, for any information that she could find about her missing husband. Right down to writing to the King of Spain. The Spanish royal family was actually helping identify missing soldiers, identifying through Turkish prisons. And, you know, it wasn't until, you know, very late in the war, 1918, that she, you know, eventually said, look, it's probably a faint hope that my husband's still alive. So for all that time, she, you know, she held, you know, that firm belief that he was still alive, that thread, that as time went on and she exhausted all avenues.
And then when the armistice came, a lot of correspondence I've seen is that they're then hoping, aren't they, that in Germany and Turkey, that the enemy would release prisoners of war, and suddenly these long lost soldiers would reappear, wouldn't they, having been in a prisoner of war camp?
Yeah, that was some of the hope, but you know that really didn't eventuate. There was really just handfuls of prisoners, and many of them were already known. But that was the forlorn hope that, maybe the forlorn hope that in some hospital there's someone that's badly damaged, lost their memory. So forever forlorn hope. Even until, there's an interesting story where Patsy Adams-Smith, she's a famous author in Australia, wrote the Anzacs, and she remembers her mother, when World War II started, she had two missing uncles, and her mother saying, maybe they'll find Jack and Peter now, the Second World War has started. And she remembers her mother, praying, kneeling and praying beneath a picture of both her sons every night in the dark, praying to them.
Just can't imagine that, can you, sitting here now?
Yeah. And that's, like Britain in those days, stiff upper lip, the ruling class, the view was that the ruling class should never show the emotion. So this was bottled up. And, there was, sayings or that often, you wouldn't see the tears. They'd be on the pillow at night, but, the public wouldn't see the tears. The curtains would be drawn and people would suffer their grief in silence.
And that made it worse, didn't it? We now know that if you let go of your grief, it helps.
Yeah, exactly. You think about Freud, that was in its infancy. These days it's talking therapies, which help rather than just simply, buttoning it up or bottling it up. And again, the stories of, mothers ending up in, institutions, wrought with grief, mothers who dreamt of, their sons that, coming to them in their dreams, and just tormented, beyond comprehension.
Because this is another level, isn't it? It's one thing losing a child. It's another thing then them being so far away because you're in Australia, or New Zealand. And then the third thing is knowing that they haven't got a grave and that nobody knows what's happened to them. So you've got different levels of grief, haven't you, there?
Yeah.
And no closure.
And I think psychoanalysts, they call it, it's been caught between hanging on and letting go.
Yeah.
So they can never let go and have that, normal process, which is disassociation over time. And look, I think the other thing too, just in the research, is, the ritual of a funeral, a body, that's something that's been important from the Stone Age. So, that's part of the grieving process. So when that's not available, people remain in that suspended state. And I think the other thing too is, and I think it informs everything, these discussions is, as humans, we've never discarded the human body just as a, an empty wrapper or an empty vessel. There has always been ritual around. And you're right, that was in essence missing. So you're forever, caught in your own grief.
And for these mothers as well, in the early 1920s and at the end of the war, there's no memorials to the missing, are there, anywhere at this stage? They're 10 years away.
No. Look, there was a big movement in Australia, as there has been in Britain, to build memorials. Where I'm in from Melbourne, they've got the Shrine of Remembrance, which I think was completed in the mid-1930s. So that was a location that any mother that lost a son, could basically grieve at and commemorate.
But that's a long time later then, isn't it? That's more than a decade.
Yeah. Well, and look, every community, built their own memorials. So, again, the book talks about that in each of those where the boys lived, how they came to build the memorials. Pilgrimages started. Now, you know, for Australia that was very hard because, you know, to get to England, that's 6 months' wages. Most people didn't have that means. So they, you know, even if there was a grave, they could, you know, rarely visit it. And as you know, Menin Gate, I think it was 1926, you know, even the Villers Bretna Memorial, 1938 or 39. But look, in Australia, there was a big movement to build those memorials because there wasn't graves to, you know, give that opportunity for people to have a quiet place where they could grieve.
So who was Vera Deakin then, and what was her role? What did she do?
So Vera Deakin, she was 23 years old when the war broke out. She's actually the daughter of the Australian Prime Minister at the time, Alfred Deakin. And, you know, Alfred Deakin, very service orientated. There's a story in the book that, you know, Australia's about manufacturing in Australia. And, you know, Alfred Deakin made sure his family wore Australian-made clothes, no matter how clumsy or poorly tailored they were. So there was very much a service orientation in the family. So at the age of 23, she had a couple of discussions, you know, how can I help the war effort? And one way was to help the Australian Red Cross Bureau into inquiry into wounded and missing soldiers. So at 23 years old, she pretty much jumped on a boat with a good friend of hers, went to Cairo. This is about the time of the Gallipoli, or just after the Gallipoli landings. And in essence, what she was doing is following up inquiries of families. So obviously a family, if you had a son missing, it was very hard to get information through official channels such as the army or base records. If you ever read base records, you know, there's inquiries from families, but it always ends with base records saying no information to date, will furnish information if it comes available, which was basically saying, look, they couldn't help. So basically it went through the Red Cross inquiries. So in essence, she developed searches, a team of searches, and basically cablegrams would come to her and she would basically follow up through researchers, just trying to get any information she could. She'd, you know, liaise, you know, through other Red Cross organisations such as the British organisation, the Swiss organisation, and in essence, you know, she's trying to get answers for families. And yeah, you know, it's like piecing together a jigsaw puzzle. You know, the searchers would be out in hospitals, interviewing wounded soldiers. They'd be interviewing other soldiers in that battalion of missing soldiers, and gradually they'd just build up a picture. So in many instances, if you look at the files, I think, and I'll probably get this wrong, but the Red Cross files that she basically collected, I think it's, you lay it out, it's about 2 kilometres of files. You know, it's just endless records.
Have they been digitised?
Yeah, it is.
Fantastic.
It's a terrific resource.
Yeah.
And it's probably one of the hardest reading you'll ever have. Basically say, hey, I was with Peter or John and, you know, I actually saw him blown to pieces, or I saw him carried away on a stretcher, I never saw him again, or I saw him, you know, forward and, you know, being shot, or sometimes it was just confused. You know, he was in the attack, but I didn't see him after that, or you know, he had a slight wound and he was walking back, and I didn't see him after that. So, you know, she was her organisation was basically getting probably about, you know, the height of battles. You know, if you take Pozieres, probably around 3,000 cablegrams per month and 2,000 letters. You know, at Passchendaele that increased to 5,000. So, in essence, she moved from Cairo, moved to London. And again, you know, that was her life's work.
And she was a young girl, wasn't she? 23 years old, a young girl.
Yeah, think about it. You know, I've got a daughter, 21, and, you know, I admire her, but, you know.
Can't imagine her doing that.
The age of 23. You know, she's forever after her father's approval. He did come across to London and, you know, gave his approval that what she was doing made a difference, which, you know, had a huge impact. But it's interesting for anyone that's as a subject, she did some recordings in the 1970s, about 6 or 7 hours of just her time with the Red Cross.
Yeah.
And it's amazing listening. You know, you've got this whirring cassette, and she's basically just talking about, you know, when you're in England, the Zeppelin raids, they wouldn't go down, you know, to the lower floors. They'd continue work. You know, they'd have a little runner that'd go out, Kitty, 13-year-old, and the police would have to come and, you know, contain her or retain her. So, you know, that you know, gave a lot of, it closed off for many parents, gave them the answers they couldn't get through official channel. And a very humble woman, and she was forever, you know, talking about how, you know, every day she was having either conversations or sending letters. And, you know, she'd talk about the conversations she'd had with the families and just how she got somewhat rude in the way she communicated it, just because of the weight that she found about it. She
must have had an impact on her as well as a person.
Yeah. I mean, interestingly, she ended up marrying a prisoner of war, and, you know, even armistice, happy period, celebration, but she just went back to her little apartment in Chelsea and just sat there by the fire with a few other women that worked with the organisation. And for her, you know, it's just all they did was reflect on, you know, many of the men and boys that had disappeared. So, but I mean, for me, she's one of the unsung heroes.
Definitely,
The Great War for Australia.
Yeah. And the three brothers then, the three sets of brothers, are they on the same memorial?
No, they're not, actually. So if I go through them, the first two brothers who died on Gallipoli, so Morden and Lindsay.
Yeah.
One is on... one is still missing, so he's on the Lone Pine Memorial.
Yeah.
One was eventually found. His remains were found in 1922, so that did provide his mother, Mary, some comfort.
Yeah.
And he's in a little cemetery just on the beach about a kilometre up from Anzac Cove. So his remains were eventually found.
Yeah.
If I look at the German family, the Flom family.
Yes.
It was interesting enough that two of the three brothers were killed, one at Fromelles and one at Passchendaele. And, you know, with the other brothers, two of them on the Menin Gate, still missing, and the third brother of the Allen brothers was on the Australian Memorial with around, you know, 10,500 other Australians.
Yeah, and this has obviously been something very personal to you, then, hasn't it? I know you've written other books as well, but this does the way you're talking now. I can feel the emotion. It means a lot to you.
Well, one of the things I made sure I did was to walk the ground. So, as you know, Terry, when you walk the ground, you can. You know, that's the best way to really sense, you know, you're in that same orbit as other people have been. So I made sure I actually walked the ground, and actually I could, from the trench maps, I was able to virtually find within, you know, 100-yard square, you know, where they'd perished. So,
and they may still be there, of course.
Well, exactly. So, you know, Gallipoli, you know, we're able to narrow it down. I had a guide there, very knowledgeable guide, and, yeah, he's able to give me some more information. You know, at Mezzanine Ridge, same thing, able to identify the area. And, you know, hey, they're probably still...
That's right.
..still buried there. You know, that gives you that connection, because people, you know, as part of the research, you know, people want that sense of connection with place. That's really important for them. In mourning, and, you know, there's many a story about, you know, a mother or father getting to the battlefields and just walking and feeling that sense of connection, because they know that, you know, that's where their son walked, or walking in the cool of the evening, again, you know, getting that sense of connection and closure.
And it doesn't have to be anything supernatural, does it? It's something within ourselves, I think, within our soul, perhaps, and within the relatives, you know, because I think anyone listening to this who have done it, they can... Whether they're religious or not, they can feel something. You can't really explain what it is.
Yeah, and I always encourage people, you know, if they are, you know, going to the battlefields or anything like that, you know, make sure you read up, because it really gives you context around what could happen. And it's, you know, if you've got a book and a map, you can virtually, you know, recreate, you know, what happened there in your own mind.
Mm.
You know, you go to locations such as Pozzuoli, you know, there's just a slight grating in the ground, but, you know, you understand how important that grating it was when you know, the Germans were on the high ground or whatnot. So I think, you know, that really gives you a much better appreciation, a much better understanding. You know, I use that example of Pozzuoli, for example. And a lot of these places are beautiful locations as well. You know, they're beautiful. You know, you go to Gallipoli, it's beautiful. And again, it's just that contrast about, you know, what happened and the actual beauty of the place as well. So as you can tell, you know, it's visiting the battlefields and understanding the stories and sharing the stories, you know, it's had a profound impact on me.
I can see that. Yeah. And what's next for you then? What's next? What's your next project?
Well, I've done a third book, which was actually a fiction book, but based on composites and composites accounts. And for me, that was an important book because the first two books I've done is nonfiction, which is probably looking from without into the human condition, whereas with fiction, you can, you know, look from within and look out. So, you know,
because you're not an author by nature then, are you? You didn't start. You're not a professional author as such.
No, just... just taught myself over, I think my first book probably took about 7 years, and 5 years of that was learning how to write. It's like anything. It's like, you know, do your 10,000 hours and you'll get there. And look, I find if you're passionate about something, you know, the other people fall into place. That was really, for me, that was a vehicle to tell the story about, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. And it was the same thing, you know. And you read a lot of dossiers and whatnot, and people say, hey, I feel queer. Or you read the repatriation files, and they're going to the doctor and saying, I feel queer, and I've got this real knot in the guts. And that was the language that they used. And they didn't have the, I suppose, the research or the maturity in psychology or psychoanalysts to actually understand, you know, what was happening to them. You know, a much better understanding. You know, that's all a shell shock or... that, you know, weren't able, you know, to diagnose or understand, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. So for me, it was a, you know, those scars, those mental scars, it was a good vehicle to actually tell that story. And again, you know, based on, you know, a lot of composite reading that I've done. So
So have you got another one that you're working on, another book?
Look, I'm working on something at the moment, 1917. Just looking at the year of 1917.
Great.
Yeah, to me, it's probably the most pivotal year of the war. You know, and it was when there was a lot of pressure on society. You know, if you look in Britain, there was a lot of strikes. If you look in Australia, there was a lot of strikes.
Yeah, we've got mutinies in France, haven't we?
Yeah, you've got the Russian Revolution. So it was almost that breaking point of society. And, you know, I think Lloyd George, you know, basically said after the war, the most important thing is I've just got to keep the people settled. You know, that's if we lose the people, the war. And, you know, if you look at the Russian Revolution, you know, quite plausible it could have happened in, you know, France. Quite plausible it could have happened in Britain. You know,
and history would have been very different, wouldn't it? History would have been very different. Yeah, and the Second World War wouldn't have happened then, would it, if we'd have lost the first? Oh, well, thanks for that. That's absolutely fantastic. And as I said, the book's not easily available in the UK, but it can be ordered through Australian sources, can't it, and shipped over?
I've got a website. I can fulfill through a website. You typically find in museums in France, for example, most of them will have the book, and if you look at the latest one, Night in Passchendaele, it's ebook. It's had voiceover as well, so you can download it.
So it's an audible book.
So they are available in Britain.
I've
shipped quite a few books to Britain and Ireland and US myself, so I do have a website.
So contact you is probably the best thing to do then, isn't it?
Through publisher.
So, excellent. All right.
Yeah.
So a big thank you there to Scott for coming on the podcast and giving us some background to those nameless names. And I promise that I would read a couple of excerpts and a few examples from his book. And there's a couple here that really had an effect on me when I read them. He says there was an Australian soldier called Ted Rawl, and he recalled an anguished mother speculating on the fate of her missing son. He says the mother said to him, "The missing do very often show up again, don't they? Probably he's a prisoner of war. Maybe he's lost his memory and is in some hospital." And Ted said, "What could I tell her? I just felt justified in telling lies." And then in his book, Ted tells the story of a soldier that was found many years after the death of his parents. There's a photograph which I'll put on my website. It says, "A proud Sergeant Jack White flashes a smile while resting a reassuring hand on his wife's Lillian's shoulder and standing protectively over his son Colin and infant daughter Myrie. While Jack beams, Lillian carries a more apprehensive expression. No doubt she felt uneasy about Jack's pending departure. Maybe that's why she gave him a lock of her own hair. And it was near Bullecourt in 1917 that Australian troops attacked the heavily fortified Hindenburg line, and where Jack, a 28-year-old blacksmith, was killed on the 2nd of May 1917, and his remains were not recovered at the time. A few personal items, such as Jack's Bible, returned to Lillian, which she was perpetually thankful for. Beyond that, she continually fretted about Jack's missing remains. Over time, their shattered lives were rebuilt. Lillian remarried and moved away from the area. While for Colin and Myrie, their father became a hazy memory. Then, 77 years on, in 1994, a Bullecourt farmer, while ploughing his field, uncovered human remains. An identity disc was found on the body, as well as the intimate possessions of a lock of hair and a faded photograph of a baby. And the soldier was identified as Jack White. The news came as a great shock to the only surviving member of Jack's immediate family, his daughter Myrie, who was now aged 80. She made the only overseas trip of her life, travelling to France for her father's funeral. With four military honours, Jack was finally laid to rest on the 11th of October 1995, and Jack was buried with that lock of hair that Lillian had presented him with. Despite the recovery of Jack's remains, there are still thousands of soldiers buried in unmarked graves in the Bullecourt fields. And as we've talked about today, you can find out more about those lads, and in particular the three sets of brothers that we talked about today, and we'll remember them now by the playing in their memory of The Last Post.